The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world. One of the biggest questions today is whether or not you evolved. Where did human life come from? Where did all the complex, intricate life around you come from? What are the answers to the most mysterious questions of all biology, such as bird migration, ecological adaptation and change, whether or not evolution really did occur, and whether or not such a thing as natural selection is really possible after all? You know, the average layman likes to leave it to the thinkers who are supposedly professionals along this line, and they are convinced, that is, the average layman is convinced that these professionals have done years of exhaustive and painstaking research, that they know precisely what they are talking about, that there exist plenty of satisfactory theories to explain the origin of human life without recourse to the belief in a divine being. As a matter of fact, recently in a symposium on the question, a conference of biologists and physical scientists from several different countries recently agreed that the theory of evolution as it stands is incomplete. The scientists were in a two-day symposium on the subject, and they were unable to define what was missing. And it was interesting that even though this blue ribbon group of scientists spent 42 hours attacking the theory of evolution. Now, mind you, they believe in evolution. They're for it 100%, but they want to update it. And so they attacked the theory of evolution as advocated by Charles Robert Darwin back in 1859. Darwin's theory came out a little bit tattered and torn. But what they reported was that after some 35 of the world's most renowned scientists argued to the point they had to shed coats and loosen ties in the conference room, that when they finished, Darwin's theory had been badly battered, but the scientists had failed to come up with a better one. And the best they could tell us was that they thought at least they had defined the argument between the biologists and the mathematicians. It's always interesting when you have a conference that you come out of it having clearly defined what the argument is, which supposedly was the reason to have the conference in the first place, isn't it? Now, it was generally agreed before they ever began the discussion that there would be no discussion of the influence of a god or any form of a supreme being. They didn't want to clutter up the air and to confuse the issue with the idea that maybe evolution wasn't right in the first place. I want to show you in this program, as I did the last time, on the subject of bird migration. Now, the reason I'm choosing bird migration is because it's only one of literally dozens, and I don't mean just dozens figuratively, I mean dozens and hundreds of very, very perplexing, baffling, and difficult mysteries in the field of biology that have scientists absolutely amazed. They have no answers for them. They come up with all kinds of theories. I want to show you what they say about it. In the words of one of the most famous evolutionists of all, Sir Julian Huxley. Now, in his book on evolution in action, he almost sounds like you might sound if you were asking about the theory of evolution and you were wondering, well, how can it possibly be true? How can various adaptations and processes of natural selection bring about such unbelievable change? Well, here's what he said. It seems to be true that natural selection can turn moths black in industrial areas, can keep protective coloration up to the mark, can produce resistant strains of bacteria and insect pests. But he asks, what about really elaborate improvements? Now, this is a question that I might ask and that you might ask, and here is an evolutionist saying, can it transform a reptile's leg into a bird's wing? Oh, incidentally, in case you didn't know it, evolutionists believe the closest living relatives to birds are crocodiles. In case you didn't know it, they believe that the intricate feathers with all their barbules and barbicles that are interlocking and the tremendous complexity of a feather, which is one of the most remarkable things under a microscope in all creation by itself, evolved from a frayed fish scale. That one day a fish rubbed a scale on a rock and it sort of halfway dislodged itself and from this frayed scale, gradually over the course of centuries and millions of years, not this one, but many others began doing this, and maybe it sort of did something to their skin, and gradually they were running around the ocean with all kinds of frayed scales, And first thing you know, as they began to climb out and develop lungs, that's rather a fabulous story all by itself. But at any rate, frayed scales became feathers. Did you know that? A lot of you didn't realize that, but that's what evolution says. So here is this evolutionist asking this question. Let's see what his answers are. Can it, that is, these elaborate improvements of natural selection, transform a reptile's leg into a bird's wing, or turn a monkey into a man? Mr. Huxley talking. How can a blind and automatic sifting process like a selection, operating on a blind and undirected process like mutation, produce organs like the eye or the brain with their almost incredible complexity and delicacy of adjustment? How can chance produce elaborate design? In a word, are you asking us to believe too much? Asked this foremost evolutionist. His answer? Almost baffling, almost as baffling as the theory. Here's his answer. Quote, the answer is no. All this is not too much to believe once one has grasped the way the process operates. Well, I'm going to show you that they haven't yet grasped the way the process operates, and it is a great deal too much to believe. Now, for instance, this same author went on to show the fantastic mathematical improbability of such change and adaptation ever occurring. It has to do with 1,000 to the millionth power. Now, if you wrote this out in figures, it would become the figure 1 with 3 million aughts after it. And that would take 3 large volumes of about 500 pages apiece just to print the figure. Now, of course, that figure is a meaningless figure. It's a figure that would extend around the earth several times. But it shows what a degree of absolute faith many of these evolutionists have. It pales into insignificance, theological faith, I'll tell you that for sure. Many theologians, religious people, have nowhere near the faith in their belief in God that many evolutionists have in their idea of evolution. Because, you see, theologians have a lot more to work with. A lot more logic, a lot more tangible promises, a lot more tests that they can use. They have a lot more fulfilled prophecy in past history that was prophesied years and even centuries before it occurred. And yet many Christians, professing Christians, seem to have weaker faith than evolutionists. Now, that's an amazing thing. The difference being, of course, that many evolutionists have absolute faith in nothing. Where faith is supposed to be the evidence of things not seen, all right, yet it is evidence, and evolution has no evidence. Now, the degree of improbability that natural selection has to surmount is this figure, 1,000 to the millionth power. 1 with 3 million aughts after it is the measure of the unlikeliness of a horse, the odds against it happening at all, of there being such a thing as a horse, mathematically. Would you bet on such odds? Now, that's amazing, but that's what people are betting on. You wouldn't bet on anything that improbable. 1 with 3 million zeros after it. You've got 1 chance out of 1,3 million zero times that a horse could evolve. That's just about putting it in mathematical terms. Would you bet on that? Would you go to the $5 window and purchase a ticket on those odds? And it is kind of odd when you stop to think about it. Now, nobody would bet on that, and yet they claim it has happened. And they say that it has happened thanks to the workings of natural selection. It makes you wonder, what is the name of this God that people are worshiping today? Thanks to the working of natural selection and the properties of living substances which make natural selection inevitable. Is it inevitable? Well, you begin to look at some of the so-called proofs of evolution, and it is really amazing. Now, on the last program, I was talking about bird migration, because the mystery of bird migration is still one of the really big, baffling problems to evolutionists. Let me explain it briefly. For an airplane to arrive on schedule somewhere, you begin to think about pre-flight planning and all the scheduling that goes into a modern jet airliner. Now, as you may not realize, even though a jet airliner flies in broad daylight, as many of the flights, of course, are in the daylight hours, yet they still have to go, as you call it, IFR. That means by instrument flight regulations. Because when you get up into the 20 and 30,000 foot altitude, you can become horizon disoriented. You can lose your way up in those altitudes just about as easily as you can in lower altitudes after dark. Now, in avionics, aviation electronics, there are instrument packages in these huge aircraft and even the tiny business aircraft of today that are really amazing. DME and ADF, this was a more common automatic direction finder that was used by tuning in the various radio frequencies and still is. Many people hear the World Tomorrow program by ADF. Got a letter the other day from a returning Navy jet pilot flying toward the United States out over the Atlantic, I believe it was. And he was tuned into a station somewhere along the East Coast, and there's a direction finder. A needle in his instrument panel would point directly to that radio station, just the point of the compass where that station's antenna was located. He was flying toward this station's antenna and tuned into the World Tomorrow program at the same time. And I've heard from some of the pilots of 707, or, not to give Boeing all the credit, DC-8s or 990s or something else. But at any rate, he was flying for Pan Am, I believe, out over the island of Guam and heard the World Tomorrow program. Now, for me to tell you that a cockpit somehow just put itself together, that all of the electronic instruments just put themselves together over vast periods of time, for me to tell you that these wings joined themselves to a fuselage and over a vast period of time this aircraft began to fly would sound a little bit ridiculous. But when you study into birds, how they are composed, what they consist of, their bone and their skeletal structure, their circulatory system, their nervous system, their digestive system, the storage of body fat, and above all things, how birds migrate, where they go, how far they go, how long they take to get there, the unerring accuracy of bird migrations, how they decide when to leave and when to stop, in other words, how far to go. Now, in pre-flight planning, a pilot must get his charts and he maps out his true course. And he's going to steer in a certain magnetic or a compass heading. But the wind is coming from another direction and it's going to blow him off course a certain number of degrees depending upon the speed of the wind, the speed of the aircraft. And so he has to make careful computations and corrections. Now also there are magnetic variations along various places in the earth. He has to read on his chart what the magnetic variation is. Now also after he's corrected that, each individual compass is a little bit different than every other compass depending upon the metal surfaces and the metal parts of the aircraft. So he has to look at his compass correction card and make a further correction. This even takes a sort of a, well, call it a circular slide rule, a computer that he has to use. Now he has to figure his exact time of departure, then his gross weight and his balance and his load. Then he has to figure the length of the runway, what the wind is blowing over it, what is the temperature, what is the sea level pressure, what is the weight of the aircraft, the weight of its load and its baggage and its fuel. Then he has to figure the exact distance he's going to fly and whether he has the fuel on board. He has to know what kind of an airport and the conditions of the weather that will be awaiting him upon his arrival. Birds, they do all these things automatically. Now, airliners sometimes lose their way. Military aircraft have lost their way. They haven't returned to their carrier. They've splashed down at sea. Sometimes airplanes fly smack into mountains. It's amazing when you look at bird migration to find out what they really do. Now, for a few moments, let me tell you just exactly what they do. It was a long time ago that certainly the name James Audubon, you know, and he was using just silver wire instead of numbered bands. This is where bird banding first began. And how he proved that a swallow returned to nest on the same beam in a Pennsylvania barn 3 years in succession, and that a robin took possession of the same porch corner season after season. The first three ruby-throated hummingbirds ever banded were caught again the next season, patronizing the same feeding station their parents had used, and between the time of banding and the year of recapture, they had traveled at least 5,000 miles to the tropics and back. A little tiny bird about maybe an inch and three-quarters or two and a quarter inches long, yet they contested for nest sites within 30 feet of the spot where they had learned to fly. Now they find that every bird doesn't migrate the same length, the same place, to the same direction, or stay as long, and the problems in this are unbelievable. How they migrate has been called one of the most perplexing problems of all biology. That they possess this ability at all is based on an overwhelming accumulation of banding and experimental evidence. And they still don't have the answers. They've wondered about kinesthetic sense. They've wondered about the sun, the moon, and the stars, but they're always changing in relationship to the Earth's orbital pattern. They've wondered about pressure, about temperature, about a drive in quest of food, but none of these things suit the conditions and the circumstances, as I will show you. Now, species that annually journey to geographically restricted goals clearly demonstrate a phenomenal attribute in bird migration. For instance, though the greater shearwater ranges over nearly all the Atlantic Ocean, individuals journeying to their breeding ground must pinpoint their flight. And they're spread out over the entirety of the ocean, yet they've all got to go to one spot. And here's the amazing thing. Maybe by reading National Geographic at some time, you remember seeing pictures of the Tristan da Cunha group of islands, which only occupy 150 square miles of the South Atlantic and lie 1,500 miles from the nearest land mass. Now, an airliner could very easily miss a little spot in the middle of the ocean like that. Very easily. Yet the entire population of this group nests in that area. Now, another bird, the Kirtland warbler, is known to nest in one restricted area of Michigan. The entire population of that species in an area less than 85 miles wide and 100 miles long, and winters exclusively in the Bahamas. And this 1,200-mile journey demands some extraordinary homing ability twice every single year. Banding studies further suggest that it's probably the rule, rather than the exception, that individuals of most species of birds habitually return to the same breeding ground and the wintering area year after year, often to the very same few acres of land. And extensive banding, as I've said, has absolutely proved this. Now, the complexities of bird migration are so extensive and complex as to be the absolute despair of analysts and researchers on the subject. They just come up with all kinds of questions, but they don't come up with very many answers. But the amazing thing is their tenacity to hang on to their conviction that there is no great creator God, that all of this just happened. Let me show you how they reason to give you a little bit of insight into it. When you ask the question, why migrate at all? Now, take, for instance, there's a certain type of ptarmigan up in the tundra, way up in the northern reaches of some of the northeastern territories of Alaska, maybe in northern Manitoba, for example. Now, here's the Arctic tern up there with them. The Arctic tern migrates all the way to the South Pole, and these ptarmigans simply turn around and change their diet and stay there and begin eating bark and twigs and all that type of thing instead of the insects that they ate in the earlier time of the year. How do you explain that? Bird biologists don't know how to explain it. They just don't have any answer. So the question is, what started migration? Now, this is a quotation from a book called The Birds by Roger T. Peterson in the Life Nature Library on page 106. And he asks the question, what started migration? Students of the question, noting that the birds of the Northern Hemisphere are the most migratory, have suggested, now here's one of the theories they have suggested, that the ice sheets during the Pleistocene epoch might have been originally responsible. Birds were forced south ahead of the advancing glaciers. How fast do glaciers advance? Well, they can move as much as a few feet a year. So these birds, you know, they didn't even need wings. They could walk or crawl. Being forced south, well, these birds didn't even have to have wings. If they're being forced by a glacier, let's face it, they could have crawled, couldn't they? They could have walked backward. They didn't need any migratory sense, that's for sure. But let's assume that they're being forced south. This is what the theory says. How far south? Well, you see, a lot of them start in northern Canada and they winter in Argentina. Others start in Britain and winter in South Africa. Others start in Europe and winter down in Zanzibar and around Cape Town in South Africa. But the theory goes they were forced south ahead of the advancing glaciers. Now, according to this theory, these are words that are, of course, rife in many of your books on evolution and biology and what have you. According to this theory, and they followed them back when they receded. They fled a glacier and then they followed a glacier back when the glacier receded. I submit to you, these could have been caterpillars you're talking about. Very simply, they could have been caterpillars, not birds. Glaciers don't come swooping down like a cold front out of Canada. Now, they say, each winter is now like a brief recurrence of the Ice Age. You know that many theologians believe that there is a representation in the Bible where it speaks of a day being like 1,000 years so far as God is concerned, so far as the way God calculates time. Now, non-theologians take great exception to this. This really bothers them that you could say, oh, come on. Use the analogy of a day for a year, yet here's evolutionary biology in this case, ornithology, saying, well, you see, each season is sort of like an echo of the ancient past where these birds took aeons to do it, but today they do it in the autumn and the spring. Well, it's sort of interesting. So they say each winter is now like a brief recurrence of the ice age, with the birds retreating to their ancestral haven and returning when the snow and the ice have gone. The idea sounds plausible.
It does? It doesn't sound plausible to me, but I don't think it sounds plausible to you. I don't even know why the author of the book said that it sounds plausible, but it is put here that the idea sounds plausible, but it does not explain migration.
Well, then, if it doesn't explain migration, how can it sound plausible? Well, here's the point. You see, there is migration occurring in many parts of the earth that have never even been touched by glaciers. Migration occurs with crabs, with eels, with salmon, with insects, with even spiders. And did you know that spiders migrate and have been proved to migrate by celestial navigation? It's a fact. We'll get to that later. But consequently, most ornithologists have now rejected the idea that this theory of retreating and advancing in face of glaciers has any contributory cause to bird migration, believing rather that it had been going on for many millions of years and not just the last 1 or 2 million years spanned by the Pleistocene. We'll come to those things later, too. Now, but here is the next statement out of the book, which I think is a really interesting one. There is no question that the process has been an evolutionary one. You see, that's the way these books are. First come all of these absolutely illogical, impossible, mathematically impossible, one chance out of one, how many centillion, trillion, quadrillion, billion, you would say. You can't even begin to put a figure like that. There isn't any words for it. So you have to say one followed by so many million zeros, one chance out of that many that it could have happened. But there is no question, they say, that it did happen. Now that is faith. That's blind faith. That is purposeless faith. That is empty faith. That is almost unbelievable faith. You've got to hand it to people who have that kind of faith. That's faith in nothing. That's faith in impossibility. That is faith in absolute, illogical, unsound, unthinkable impossibility. But that's the kind of faith some people have. So they went on to say that birds originating in warm climates probably spread outward in their search for food. Many found it in abundance in higher latitudes, but were forced to withdraw when winter came. Although many of the adventurers perished, natural selection has favored the survival of the more flexible individuals. There's that warm, wonderful, guiding hand of good old faithful natural selection. You know, even though a moth turns dark, he's still a moth. Even though a snowshoe hare turns white, it's still a hare. That doesn't prove a thing. Ecological adaptations of birds eating different things in different seasons doesn't prove a thing. But we just never do come to grips with it. People just never do really look into evolution and ask a few embarrassing questions. Can they really prove it after all? It's about time you did. Because at stake is the question, is there a God? Does that God really live? Is that God alive? Did Jesus Christ really walk the earth? And is Jesus Christ alive today? And is the purpose and the program that is spelled out in the Bible really going to come to pass? The question of evolution does not admit the idea that there could be a God. This symposium they had, they rolled up their sleeves and went to work, and they agreed among themselves not to think about the idea of there being a divine, all-wise God. They thought about this before they ever entered the meeting. This was a pre-assumed idea that all of them accepted before they ever began to question the various mathematical and biological difficulties in some of the evolutionary questions. They were not going to clutter up their meeting with the idea there could be a God. But when you see evolutionists telling you, first of all, about the unearthly difficulties, about the utter impossibilities of evolution, and then say, but there is no question that it had to be an evolutionary process, then you see admissions in the newspaper of how they agree to disagree before they start. They agree to say that there can be no other answer but evolution before they begin, and are not willing to look into it. Well, it's about time you, the layman, began to ask a few questions. Now, if you want help in asking those questions and in getting the answers and knowing how to ask the right questions and to research it for yourself, then write in for the Plain Truth magazine. This current number has the article on migrating birds and tells you, as I have been telling you on this program and the last one, some of the most absolutely unanswerable difficulties of the evolutionary theory lie in bird migrations. They are hair-raising. It's really staggering what can occur. And the fact that many of these birds, little tiny birds about 2 inches long, travel 125 miles per day for many days to go over the course of thousands of miles to sit on the same twig and to be captured at the same banding station, the same nesting area where they left. Evolution has no answer, but the Bible does. And if you want to write for this Plain Truth magazine, it's absolutely free of charge, no price for it, other articles, every single number. There is, for instance, every number, the Bible story for children. And every number, articles from Europe, from our correspondents and our contributing editors around the world, in Australasia, Southeast Asia. Articles written from behind the Iron Curtain in the current number, showing you modern Romania, what's happening in the new agreements between West Germany and Romania and Spain and Romania, and what's happening in the common market, how it's going to fulfill prophecies that have been contained in your Bible for all these years. Now also every number of the Plain Truth magazine, letters from around the world. It's full color, 52 pages, no advertising, absolutely free of charge. Now also the booklets on Does God Exist? And the proof of the Bible will help you get at the real important questions about whether or not you can believe there is a God, or whether you ought to just let other people do your thinking for you. It may come as a surprise that not all scientists accept evolution. You may know the name of Dr. Werner von Braun, who was the head of Hitler's V-1 and V-2 rocket experiments in World War II, and has since been at the head of the United States space program. Spends a good deal of time in Germany, of course, but also a good deal of time in the United States in Cape Kennedy. He asked, why do I believe in God? Simply stated, he said, the main reason is this. Anything so well ordered and perfectly created as is our earth and universe must have a maker, a master designer. Here is a top scientist in his field. He doesn't believe in evolution. Here is a man dealing with nuclear physics, with space systems, with the complexities and the intricacies, the miniaturization in the American space program. He doesn't believe in evolution. He's a top scientist. Not all scientists believe in evolution. Many of them believe in God. This one said, anything so orderly, so perfect, so precisely balanced, so majestic as this creation can only be the product of a divine idea. There must be a maker. There can be no other way. And that's the exact fact. There isn't any other answer. Any other answer is blind faith in nothingness and a denial of the facts the way they really are. There is only one answer. There either is a God, or you don't have any answer for the existence of the universe, the earth, and all life upon it. Write for the Plain Truth magazine. You'll be glad you got it and began reading these articles, the Nature series of articles that we've begun in the Plain Truth magazine on this same subject. And also write for our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. It's full color, a booklet you can read in about one sitting, and it could be newspaper inside of it that tells you exactly what conditions will be like on this earth in the future. It's free of charge. There is no price for it by writing to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Now, all we ask is to tell us the radio station to which you've been listening. There is no cost. There is no bill of cost.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.